from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Dave Iverson. At this point, the presidential election is all about numbers, or one number, to be exact, 270. That's the number of electoral votes needed to win the White House. States like California and Texas are already decided, so Barack Obama and Mitt Romney are practically living in places like Ohio, Florida, and Colorado, the battleground states. As we learned in 2000, you can win the popular vote and lose the election, like Al Gore did. But there's a movement to change that, to scrap the Electoral College and replace it with the popular vote. But is it a good idea? That's our topic this hour, and we'll get started with Forum right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in today for Dave Iverson. Well, after the 2000 presidential election, Al Gore used to joke that you win some, you lose some, and then there's that third category. Well, that would be U.S. presidential elections, of course, where you can get the most votes but lose anyway because you fail to win a majority of electoral votes allotted by the states. It's why President Obama and Governor Romney are spending so much time in just 9 battleground states. And it can leave the rest of us feeling, well, a little taken for granted. For years, there's been a movement to eliminate the Electoral College and replace it with a national popular vote. And this hour, we're going to look at the history of the Electoral College, its pros and cons, and whether scrapping it might be a good idea. Joining us right here in the studio, Jack Rakove is here. He's a William Robertson Coe Professor of History and American Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. Good to have you with us here.
Good morning, Scott.
Also with us by phone, John Kosa. He's chairman of the National Popular Vote, Inc., which they advocate implementation of that National Popular Vote for president. Good morning to you as well.
Good morning, Scott.
Also here, Trent England, Vice President of Policy for the Freedom Foundation, a Washington-based nonprofit. Good to have you with us this morning from Washington State.
Very glad to be here.
And finally, Ace Smith, joining us by phone from the city here. He's a principal in SCN Strategies, a 30-year veteran of state and national politics. Ace Smith, good morning to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Let me begin with you, Jack Rakove, if I may. History. Give us some context. What were the founders thinking when they came up with this kind of cockamamie system?
Well, I don't want to go so far as to say it's cockamamie, but it does have some serious problems. I think the best way to think about this is to realize that for the framers of the Constitution, the adoption of the Electoral College, literally at the very end of their deliberations, virtually the last thing they did, was essentially to adopt the least unsatisfactory solution to the problem of electing a president. And to talk about intelligently, I think it's important to understand that there was no real precedent in the 18th century for the idea of how you would choose a national executive based on Republican principles. Lowercase r, as I always tell my students, lowercase r. Republican principles for a national republic. The dominant models of executive power in the 18th century were monarchical government or the kind of version emerging in Great Britain of ministerial government. The Americans had effectively rejected both, back in 1776, but they had no obvious substitute for what a new idea or new practice for having a Republican executive would be. So they had to make it up as they went along. James Madison said, describing the process of forming the presidency, he called it the outcome of a process of tedious if reiterated discussions. And I think essentially what happened was that there were two obvious alternatives, and the framers found fatal objections with both. One, which was discussed briefly, was popular election, which had two problems. If you had a popular election, Southern voters would be disadvantaged because you couldn't apply the 3/5 rule, which is a way of solving the problem of choosing representatives. Second problem was that I think the framers assumed that post-George Washington, you'd have a serious information problem. It'd be very difficult to say or let's say to identify truly national characters. So they ruled popular election out pretty quickly.
And so they basically, was it, when you say the national figures, why was that a problem?
Well, because you could assume most voters will vote on a fairly parochial basis. So, there'll be a favorite, you know, they're most likely to vote for local or regional characters. It'd be really hard to form a national majority. In fact, that turns out to be wrong. As soon as you get to 1796 and 1800, where you have contested elections with John Adams and Thomas Jefferson being the leading candidates, you learn pretty quickly that with the degree of party coordination, which they had, you could, in fact, make an effective choice. So they rule out popular election. The obvious alternative is legislative election. If you have the president chosen by Congress, you solve the information problem. That's meaning legislators, nobody will have a better idea of who the eligible candidates are than legislators. But the framers had different issues about making the presidency relatively independent of the legislature. They were moving away from what Americans had thought back in 1776. So they wanted to have a somewhat vigorous presidency, and if the president was to be elected by Congress in one form or other, it would become the weaker branch. So I think at the end they deadlock on this in August. There's a kind of five states within the convention as to what the outcome should be. It goes into a committee known as the Committee on Postponed Parts, meaning the things they hadn't resolved. And it came out of the committee in the modern form. They went back to the electoral system, which they'd also discussed briefly and then rejected because they said they had no idea who the electors would be. But so they adopted in the end without great confidence, I really think, in how it was going to work.
So the way it works now, I mean, we still vote for electors, you know.
And mostly, right, yeah, yeah.
And no one really thinks about that, and no one really knows who they are.
Right.
But they do, in fact, get together and vote in is it January or December? I guess it is in December.
Right.
Why do we still do that part of it? I mean, why not just assign the electoral votes to the states and just be done?
Well, the electoral votes are assigned to the states. I mean, each state legislature under Article II.
But then they have this other process go through.
Each state has the right. John Kosa will want to say more about this, but each state has the right to determine how its electors will be appointed. And that's a big part of the whole National Popular Vote Initiative. It's become obviously very pro forma today, except once every blue moon or so, an odd elector will toss a vote away. But so, you know, when you are voting for the presidency in any state, legally, you are effectively voting. I mean, you know, there'll be the big ticket names up there. Literally, the head of the ticket will be up there. But effectively, you're voting for an elector or for a slate of electors in your state.
And essentially, it is winner take all. You win the whole state's electoral votes. But there are a couple of quirky exceptions.
Well, Maine and Nebraska have a system where you get two for carrying the state, corresponding to the two electoral votes which represent the senators. And then they follow the congressional districts. And so, curiously, Obama picked up an elector in Nebraska the last time out, but the Nebraska Republicans have redistricted in a way that make that much less likely this time.
But in an election this close, both campaigns, I imagine, are at least thinking about trying to win. I heard just the other day that Romney was up in Maine trying to maybe pick off one electoral vote up there.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So is there a sense that, or what's your sense of how how the wisdom of that system has changed?
Well, I think the wisdom, go back to what I said originally. I mean, it was extremely experimental. They didn't have a good precedent for it. As soon as they had contested elections, a lot of party innovation takes place. You do get an informed electorate that would have been capable in, you know, many cases of making an effective choice with some kind of majority-based plurality-based system of voting. And, you know, the guys who helped to design the presidency, including no less than Madison and Alexander Hamilton, get intensely involved in electoral politics and learning how to manipulate the rules for choosing electors. So I think experimentally, I think they did not have a very well-rounded set of assumptions in 1787. But very quickly, within a decade, you know, by 1796 and certainly by 1800, they are experimenting. They're implementing. They're very active about trying to figure out how to exploit the system for partisan advantage.
Jack Rakove, he is a professor of history and American studies at Stanford University, talking this morning about the Electoral College, which is about to play very large in the outcome of this year's presidential election. John Kosa, let me bring you in. You, as I said at the top, chairman of the National Popular Vote, Inc. Organization. What's your argument for scrapping the Electoral College?
Well, our purpose is to reform the Electoral College so that it guarantees the White House to the candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states. in the District of Columbia. And the states have the power under the Constitution to award their electoral votes in any manner that they see fit. And what we've done is gone to the state legislatures. We have bills in all 50 states. We are law in 9 states, including California. And our law says that California will give its 55 electoral votes to the presidential candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states, provided that enough other states representing a majority of the Electoral College have passed similar laws.
And so what are we up to now in terms of the number of electoral votes represented by states who've signed on?
Well, the 9 states that have signed on have 132 electoral votes, which is just short of half of the 270 we need.
Yeah.
So we're hoping to get to 270 in time for the 2016 election.
So you're not saying get rid of the Electoral College. You're just sort of saying we'll override it if the national vote doesn't sync up with what the Electoral College says.
Well, we would appoint a majority. Our bill, if it's in effect in 2016, would result in the appointment of at least 270, which is enough to elect the president, 270 electors who are prepared to vote for the candidate who got the most votes in all 50 states. So we're not overriding anything or abolishing anything or replacing it. We're changing what the Electoral College would represent.
Now, you can just sort of hear lawyers licking their chops at this one. I mean, if you think about Bush v. Gore in 2000 and the lawyers descending upon Florida to litigate that one, still controversial today, what makes you think that, you know, it wouldn't just get tied up in the courts and, who knows what would happen?
Well, the nation has plenty of experience with elections in which the candidate who gets the most votes wins the office. And the chance of a recount is about 1 in 160 elections, which means in presidential terms, you would have a presidential election worth a recount about 1 in 640 years. The reason you ask that question about recounts is because the current system is so bad in producing unnecessary recounts when there's not really a close election. We saw that in 2000. Where Al Gore won the country by 500,000 votes, but the issue came down to 537 votes in one state. So the problem with the current system is that it produces unnecessary disputes and artificial crises because every election is 51 separate elections.
And Jack Rakoff, beyond the question of recounts, I mean, is there a question of constitutionality?
Well, as John knows, since we were at a conference together around this a week ago and talked about this at Stanford a couple of weeks before that, I think there is. I think there's this basic question as to whether or not the NPV alternative
National Popular Vote.
National Popular Alternative. It is a fact. It is literally a compact among the states. There is a clause in the Constitution that says compacts, interstate compacts, are subject to congressional approval. I mean, John has a line of argument, and there is a recent set of cases suggesting that the Supreme Court has relaxed its criteria for which compacts need to be approved by Congress and which not. But in my view, just I say this more as a political historian and a constitutional historian, it seems to be most unlikely that Congress would that Congress would not want to act, and B, that the Supreme Court would not treat this as a fresh issue. You are talking about constitutional change of a fairly fundamental nature, and the idea that the Supreme Court has already sent to this, in advance, strikes me personally as being nuts.
Well, John Kosa, just go ahead. Yeah,
it's nuts.
React to being nuts.
Let's focus on the reality. We were at a conference last week in Boston, and we had an hour session on constitutionality. We had two lawyers on the supposedly on the side that there was some constitutional problem with the national popular vote. And after an hour of discussion, they hadn't cited a single section of the Constitution that they thought was violated by the national popular vote plan. The question of whether it requires congressional consent has nothing to do with whether the legislation is constitutional. It has to do with a legal argument. Jack has his own opinion, which differs from the Supreme Court,
yeah,
by the way. But regardless of whether Jack is right or not, the fact is that whether it requires congressional consent has nothing to do with whether the bill is constitutional.
Well, let's just play this out for the sake of argument. Let's say that this compact, we did have the necessary states who were part of it, and California was now part of this compact. And, you know, we're heading into an election where, you know, it's conceivable that Mitt Romney is going to get to win the national vote, and Barack Obama could get the most electoral votes. So let's suppose we have that scenario, and on election day, California, or the day after, or whenever it occurs, California gives its 55 electoral votes to Mitt Romney and helps him become president. Can you imagine what would happen here in California?
Well, nothing would happen because that's the law. And
you don't think there'd be protests? You don't think there'd be some reaction, recall campaigns?
Well,
I mean, all kinds of things.
We have actual evidence of what happens. In 2000, George W. Bush had 271 Republican presidential electors, but Al Gore had won the popular vote. The 271 Republican electors did exactly what they were supposed to do. They followed the law of their state. They followed the general understanding under which the campaign had been conducted. And 71 of them, voted for George W. Bush, not for Al Gore. So we have actual experience. Sure, somebody may protest. Who cares? The fact is the law is the law, and Republican electors will vote for Republicans. And Democratic electors will vote for Democrats.
Trent England, give us your position as Vice President of Policy for the Freedom Foundation. I assume you think the current system works just fine.
Well, that's right. I don't think there's no perfect way to elect the President of the United States. And I think that Jack did an outstanding job describing the formation of the Electoral College. But what is really important is how it actually works or the incentives that it creates in our political process. And the reality is that forcing national political parties and presidential campaigns to build an electoral college majority rather than just a pure national popular vote majority is better for our country. It forces them to build slightly broader coalitions. It forces them to be slightly more moderate than they would otherwise be. And while it makes some people unhappy in each election, when you look at it over the long term and when you look at the broad sweep of American politics, you see that it has time and again pulled us back toward the center and prevented things like vote fraud from swaying the election outcome.
You're shaking your head, Jack Rakoff. You don't think that it does build a more sort of moderate consensus in the country?
Well, one, it raises the question whether a moderate consensus is good by itself. Second, it kind of does skip over the issue of 1860, 1861, when it's precisely the outcome of the Electoral College, the fact that you could capture the presidency on a solidly regional vote, independent of the popular vote, which actually leads the nation into civil war. So the idea that it's been an unmitigated success, I think, needs a little qualification.
A. Smith, go ahead, Trent. Go ahead.
The election of 1860, though, is a great example where what did the Democrats do when they split their party? They made a conscious decision that they would not be governed by the Electoral College, right? They had to decide that their ideological objectives were more important than winning the presidency. The Electoral College was still pulling them in the opposite direction, but there simply were other forces at play that overcame the more beneficent effects of the Electoral College in 1860.
I'm sure most of our listeners know, but that, of course, was the election that Abraham Lincoln got elected. A. Smith, let me bring you into this. How does this system that we have with the Electoral College, how does it frame the thinking of campaign consultants and people who run these national or statewide, but national in particular, national campaigns for candidates running for president?
Well, it leads to some crazy results. I mean, look at California, where we are. You come to California if you're a presidential candidate for money, not for votes. That's crazy. That's just crazy. The fact that we're sitting here in one of the most populous states in the union, and you don't have to actually come here, seeking election as president of the United States. I mean, the system is anachronistic. It needs to be changed. And, what we have now in the acid test for this is very clear. And one of the huge mistakes that Gore people made was frankly, not you know, creating enough of hue and cry over the fact that they had won the popular vote and lost on this anachronistic system. And the fact of the matter is that that outcome would have changed history in a profoundly positive way. And you know, instead we had to endure eight years of George Bush.
Let's come back to this question of strategy, though. How does it affect, I mean, now we, as we see in the, throughout the really most of this year, but certainly in the last several weeks, we've seen the candidates hopscotching across Iowa and Florida and Nevada and Colorado and a little bit up to New Hampshire. So how do they figure out, you know, how to allocate their time?
Well, I mean, simply you look at all the, you know, key swing votes and you flood those markets. And that's what's, you know, I mean, that's been happening ever since, you know, the beginning of the Electoral College vote. But one of the things that historically has changed, though, is that in the 19th century, really the big populous states, New York and Ohio, were the swing vote states. And you know, and what's really happened is that, you know, the more populous states are not really, New York and California and Texas, for that matter, are not, you know, the swing states.
Yeah. John Kosa, if we had a national popular vote, how do you think it would affect? Would it bring the candidates to California more necessarily? I mean, would how would it affect campaigning in the state, and who might see more of the candidates and who might see less?
Well, under a national popular vote, every person's vote in every state would be equal, so it would be inconceivable for candidates to ignore California and Texas and New York and New Jersey and Illinois and 12 of the 13 smallest states and most of the states in between. 4 out of 5 Americans are left out of the election because of the winner-take-all rule. That means that the only places worth campaigning right now are the swing states such as Ohio and Florida and so forth. So under a national popular vote, every vote would matter. It would be run like a campaign for governor. And when you run for governor of California, you campaign in big cities, you campaign in rural areas, you campaign in exurbs, you campaign in suburbs, and we see what happens.
Yeah, although the reality is, I mean, how often do gubernatorial candidates go up to Reading? I mean, they still hit the big...
I can tell you the winning gubernatorial candidates, Reagan, Duke Majan, Wilson and Schwarzenegger never came close to winning the big cities in California. They never won Los Angeles or San Francisco or Oakland or San Jose. You bet your dollar they went up to Reading because that's how they got a majority, because every vote in California was equal. And in the governor's election, if you want to be a serious campaign for candidate for governor, you campaign everywhere.
Jack Rakove, just a quick comment before we hit the break here. Who do you think in the current system are sort of the winners and losers in terms of voters, I guess, or states maybe?
You know, it's a curious question because, you know, in one sense, there's the argument that we feel disfranchised if our state isn't really competitive. On the other hand, you know, we're going to turn out large numbers in California to vote. Our votes are going to count. They really do matter. If you live in a battleground state, you know, it's not clear you want to be there. And subject, you know, there's just actually a news item on NPR this morning, you know, driving in. I think the great trade-off is if we had a national election, the whole citizenry would feel actively engaged, not just because we feel some kind of emotional and, you know, political commitment in the outcome, but we would feel like we really were the objects of attention.
All right. We're going to continue talking about the Electoral College in the rest of this hour. We're going to take a short break. And if you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning for Dave Iverson, and hope you stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer in this morning for Dave Iverson. And our topic is the Electoral College, the system we use to elect presidents in this country. And joining me in the studio, Jack Rakove. He's a professor of history and American studies at Stanford University. His latest book, by the way, is called Revolutionaries, A New History of the Invention of America. Also with us by phone, John Kosa, chairman of National Popular Vote, Inc. They're advocating implementation of a nationwide popular vote for president. And Trent England, vice president of policy from the Freedom Foundation, a Washington-based nonprofit, and Ace Smith, a principal in SCN Strategies, a longtime veteran of state and national policies. If you want to join us here this morning for your comments, 866-733-6786 is the number. Let's go right to the phones, and Fairfield is our first stop. John is on the line. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go right ahead.
So, you know, I think this whole notion of getting rid of the Electoral College is really ludicrous. You know, we're a republic of 50 states. The whole reason why we have the Electoral College is so that we don't disenfranchise the less popular states. If we remove the Electoral College, the swing states won't become an issue. It'll be the states with the most population, and those states would become moot, the swing states, that is. So the Electoral College is designed fundamentally because we're a republic of 50 states, not based on individuals electing a president.
Jack Rakove, is that how you see it?
No, I don't see it that way at all. I mean, if you're concerned about representing the states, that already takes place fairly adequately through the processes of representation. Whether you talk about the House of Representatives or the Senate, you already have an adequate and sufficient basis for taking into account local interests in the development of the political will of the American people, broadly defined. What makes the presidency exceptional is the one truly national office. And, you know, the objection doesn't really go to the fact that most states do feel both large and small states do feel disfranchised. I mean, key thing to note is what makes a state a battleground state is just it's an accident of demography. It's a question of does its population have to be, you know, happen to be divided in somewhat random ways so that it's politically balanced.
But has that changed over the years? I mean, it seems now that the country is more divided, although, as I say that, I think back to 1960 when it was a very close election, as well as 2000. But, you know, does it seem like there are fewer battleground states now because the geography has changed or the geopolitical makeup of our states has changed?
Well, it waxes and wanes. Obama did a great job of enlarging the number of battleground states, partly last time around, perhaps because he's Obama and he had a very arresting candidacy, at least the first time. Also because there are fundamental demographic shifts, which change the demography. And, of course, the Republican Party may or may not be doing its best to change the dynamics here because it's taking this kind of crazy veer to the right that may be, in fact, impairing its position in some states.
Yeah. All right, John, thanks very much for the call. We had an email, by the way, or website comment from James who wrote, in Wyoming, each electoral vote represents approximately 189,386 individual citizens. In California, each electoral vote represents about 685,000 individual citizens. So each Wyoming vote counts as nearly four California votes. And Jack Rakove, that's the math, right? I mean,
it means presidential elections violate what I think of as the basic principle: one person, one vote. All votes should count equally.
And that would be true. I'm sorry.
I think that the trouble with that, though, is that there isn't this radical skewing of the vote through the Electoral College, right? We see. We've seen just a few times in more than 200 years of history where someone has won the Electoral College and not won the most popular vote. So the fact that that votes appear to be weighted very very differently doesn't seem to have a practical effect. But I think the point about states is more important than Jack suggests. I mean, on the one hand, there is this argument about the political will of states, and that's clearly the founders' intent in the actual Electoral College provision in Article 2 of the Constitution. But more than that, I mean, the Electoral College allows us to keep election administration at the state level or below, and it allows us to use states to isolate election problems, concerns about election fraud. These things previously in American history have been extremely important, where, you know, arguably the Electoral College is the only reason we've been able to prevent election fraud from stealing the presidency. So I think that the fact that we are using states in the Electoral College has proven to be a huge benefit, and the caller was right to suggest that we should not, we shouldn't lightly do away with that.
Trent England from the Freedom Foundation. You know, it would be fun before the break, Jack, you mentioned be careful what you ask for, because, you know, I was visiting my brother in New Hampshire during the summer, and it is a battleground state. And it was just every ad on TV was for the presidential election. And so, you know, it could be worse. You know, we could be inundated with those ads. Now, of course, we're getting all the propositions on TV, but it would be fun, and since we're heard nationally or worldwide via satellite, to hear from some people living in some of those battleground states. How do you feel being, you know, the focus of all this attention from the presidential campaigns? 866-733-6786, the number. And let's go now to Palo Alto, and Arthur is on the line. Good morning.
Thank you very much. This is a very important topic. I'd like to actually touch on something that was just spoken by the speaker from the Freedom Foundation, and that is the idea that if there is a recount, we have to do a recount nationally, and the standards for doing that are essentially non-existent and problematic. With a lot of voting machines without paper trails, there really isn't a method of doing recounts. So how would we do an effective recount if we need to?
John Kosa?
Well, the fact is we didn't have a recount in 2000. There was ample justification with the presidency at stake with 537 votes to have done a recount in Florida, and there wasn't one. There was also
they
started one, but they didn't finish it. And in 1960, the only recount that occurred in Hawaii occurred after the Electoral College met. So the current system is far from perfect. The proper solution, I think, is for Congress to exercise its power under the counting provision and establish a national recount formula. But to say that that's a defect in the national popular vote, the fact is the recount laws of Florida and Ohio are going to be what determine the presidency under the current system, and we've seen that repeatedly, or for that matter, in 1960, where you had a close election in Illinois.
Jack Rakoff.
Well, another point of the added here and goes back to say the opposite of what Trent said. I think it would be a great idea, as John just suggested, to have a kind of national standardization of voting. Think about the situation that exists in Florida in 2000, where the Secretary of State, you know, legally in charge of, assessing the vote, in fact, was also the chair of the Bush campaign committee, for the state of Florida. Think about the situation in Ohio, where there's a lot of discussion about the laws of voting, where the Secretary of State is also a partisan Republican. So the idea that there's some advantage to having the control of the vote decentralized to the state in the local level. And I say this as a native Cook County Democrat, which I am and, loyally adhere to, just strikes me as getting the story backwards.
All right, back to the phones now. Neil in San Francisco, welcome.
Yeah, if there was direct election by popular vote for president of the United States, wouldn't there have to be a proviso for a runoff election in case neither of the candidates got 51% of the vote? And wouldn't there have to be a backup for that? For instance, if neither candidate in the runoff got 51%, wouldn't Congress have to decide the election?
Well, and also there's the possibility of a 269-269 tie in the Electoral College, right?
There's no requirement now for an absolute majority. In fact, 14 of the presidents have been elected with less than an absolute majority of the vote, starting with Lincoln at 39% and working your way up. Bill Clinton twice. In Clinton's election, in 49 out of 50 states, no candidate got a majority. So the notion that we need a runoff is... if we needed a runoff, why aren't we having them under the current system?
Yeah.
Well, there's actually a good reason for that, and that is that the Electoral College outcome, if you look at actual elections, is more democratic than countries that have direct election with runoffs. And this is something interesting that scholars have looked at and found that we do about double the number of authentically democratic outcomes with our electoral college system than you see in these countries that have a direct election and a runoff election after that. So, again, the electoral college in practice, right, not in theory, but when we look at actual elections and compare them to actual elections in other countries, the Electoral College works very well and solves the problem that national popular vote would actually create.
But that's just not the case. As a matter of fact, let's be real. There's been four elections in American history, and we've had 44 presidents where the one with the popular vote lost. And yeah, that's a pretty high percentage, if you ask me. And secondly, in to your point about fraud, the greatest fraud ever perpetrated on the American people was in the 1876 election. It was stolen through the Electoral College. I mean,
that's exactly wrong. The Electoral College prevented racist vote fraud in southern states from stealing the election. If the election had been fair, then Hayes would have won both the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. So that's you're getting the history exactly incorrect.
And Jack Rakoff, that was an election that went to the House, was it?
I have to pick off on this one.
Okay. But let me, A. Smith, I know you need to go. So I'm going to, before you go, I just want to say, is it fair to say that you think campaigns and campaign consultants, would they prefer to see just a national, straight up national popular vote, or do they like the system the way it is? Does it give them more flexibility and more options?
I think the truth is, if you are in the business of trying to win elections, you figure out how to work within whatever system. I think the main difference would be this. Remember California during the 2008 Democratic primary, what an interesting, fascinating election that was, with Obama and Hillary Clinton just really canvassing the entire state. That's the sort of thing it would open up, and we've seen it here in California in recent times. And you would not, the Midwest and these other places would not be neglected. You would have to make swings through, all parts of the country. It would just open up the process.
All right. A. Smith from SCN Strategies, thanks so much for joining us this morning. John Koso, what about the idea that, by forcing candidates to go to some of these swing states like Iowa, the smaller states in particular, even, Nevada, Colorado, that you bring up issues that are important to those states that might get ignored? I suppose the flip side, and we actually had an email about this, is that it kind of encourages them to pander to some of those issues. But what's your thought about that?
Well, let's be clear here. Small states get no advantage under the current system. 12 of the 13 of them have been ignored for the last six elections. The only exceptional small state that's gotten any attention is New Hampshire, which has been a closely divided battleground state. So this notion that a vote in Wyoming is worth more than a vote in California is exactly backwards. They're both worthless in terms of presidential elections. They're equal. To answer your question, the policy distortions of the current system are manifest. In 2001, George Bush, the free trade president, came out for steel quotas. Why? Because Pennsylvania and Ohio are potentially battleground states. Obama put in the stimulus bill a train from Orlando to Tampa, a train to nowhere, when in fact the useful place for high-speed rail is the Acela Corridor, which goes from Washington up to Boston, has been profitable for years, and is the kind of rail line that should be turned into a high-speed rail. And you can go issue after issue, ethanol, the Ricotta cheese factory that got a big grant in Ohio. The fact is that you bet your bottom dollar those battleground states do get attention, and it does distort policy. But there's 41 other states in the United States, and I think issues important to California and all the other states should be considered. Why don't we hear about Pacific Rim trade or high-tech issues? For the simple reason that high-tech issues are concentrated by accident in the non-battleground states, Washington, Oregon, California, Arizona, Texas, Massachusetts, New York, and a couple of others.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. We have a real live caller from a battleground state, Mark in Florida. Thanks for calling.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Fine. My question is, when it comes to the popular vote versus the Electoral College, my understanding was in the 2000 election when Bush won Texas, you get to a certain point where they quit counting the popular vote when the vote was, every vote that was left went for the other candidate, the outcome wouldn't change. Is that correct?
Yeah, Jack Rakoff.
Well, I mean, yeah, no one quits counting in the literal sense of the term because there are lots of
other things on the ballot.
You know, there are all these other issues, and you're legally obliged to count all the all the check marks for all the issues. I'd like to come back kind of quickly, I think, to a point that John made. Part of the issue if we had a national popular vote might be active campaigning, meaning what places do candidates visit. How much would that change? You know, Richard Nixon, back in 1960, famously made a pledge to campaign in all 50 states, which turned out actually be a kind of defect for him because he banged up his knee. He lost some time campaigning. He felt honor bound to stick to the pledge, and it probably impaired his ability to campaign where he most needed. I think the better way to think about this, though, is to understand that I think the parties, the candidates and the parties, if we had a national popular vote, would discover incentives to turn out their votes wherever they are. I mean, look at the current election, which indicates, that the national electorate is pretty closely divided between Obama and Romney. Again, there's no incentive to turn out the vote in areas that are essentially non-competitive. If you had a national election where each vote counted the same, doesn't mean that the candidates would visit every constituency or every district, but it does mean that the parties would have much more of an incentive to try to maximize their output wherever they found it. Big cities, suburbs, exurbs, and also rural counties.
All right, Mark, thanks very much for the call. We put a question on our Facebook page about the Electoral College. Does it need to be reformed or abandoned? Let me read some of the comments. Joe writes, abandoned. Here in California, Obama will win, no question. Thus, a vote for Romney really doesn't count. The same goes for a vote for Obama in a state like Texas. Saying anyone's vote matters is a lie unless one lives in a swing state. Noah writes, we won't. The Electoral College is a key factor in campaigning, and that is big business these days. Ben writes, while I believe the powers that be and control the whims of American politics, proportional distribution of state electoral votes is essential. And Ananda writes, abandoned. Who is the Electoral College anyway? Shouldn't I know someone who's on it? How do they get chosen? It's a bit too mysterious, isn't it? Jack Rakoff, do you know any electors?
Yeah, actually, I met one. I'm a member of a temple, Congregation Beth Jacob in Redwood City, and a guy I know reasonably well there who's active in San Mateo County politics turns out is an elector. So,
how do
yeah.
you become one? What do you?
Well, I think it's because he's active. He got designated. Years ago when we lived in New York, my wife thought she might get appointed an elector, and we turned out for a meeting in Syracuse. Nothing happened, but she wound up getting her photograph in the New York Times.
And these are people who are thought to be, party loyalists. And
yeah, almost typically. Yeah.
Whose vote can't be swayed to vote for someone else.
Right.
Under your system, John Kosa, that would change, wouldn't it? I mean, how are you going to get an elector who's sworn to vote for Barack Obama to vote for Mitt Romney?
Oh, I don't think you would, but that's not how our system works. If Mitt Romney gets the most popular votes in all 50 states, and if our compact were in effect in this election, there would be 271 Republican electors who are very loyal to Mitt Romney and will be very happy to vote their conscience and their party and their pre-announcement, and they'll support it. We aren't twisting the arms of any Democrats to vote for Republicans or vice versa.
But if Obama were to carry the state, then those electors would be chosen, wouldn't they? I mean, wouldn't they be
No, that's what our bill does.
No, it would change that. That's what it would change.
It changes the awarding of electoral votes. So instead of the electoral votes of, say, Vermont, all three of them going to the candidate who carries Vermont, the three would go to the candidate who carries the popular vote in all 50 states. So there's no problem with the electors. They will be very happy to vote for their party's nominee.
All right, let's get another email message here from Bill. He writes, my concern with changing the Electoral College is that we would no longer have a national candidate, but the country would have dozens or even hundreds of regional candidates representing small concerns. This would not help the unity of America. And Brad writes, the simplest solution to reforming the current electoral system would be to have each congressional district's vote determined separately, as in Maine and Nebraska, with statewide vote determining those two remaining electoral votes in each state. Jack Rakoff, are there
The last is a terrible idea. If you wanted to apportion votes within the states, you don't want to do it on the basis of congressional districts because congressional districts are subject to partisan gerrymandering. That's exactly what's happening in Nebraska now with the district that Obama carried back in 2008. So if, in fact, you wanted to apportion the electors you know, based on, you know, how much each candidate, you know, wins or carries in each state. You want to do it on a statewide basis. You don't want to do it by congressional districts because they're subject to such intense partisan manipulation.
Well, that does raise another question. Are there other electoral reforms short of a national popular vote that, you know, would make some sense or should be considered, do you think?
Well, John and I could talk – actually, all three of the panelists could talk about this because we had some discussion of this at this conference we attended last week at MIT. There's a whole array of different schemes of voting. Ranked ordered voting, you know, voting where you assign X number of points to first, second, third, fourth place finishers.
We'll have Don Parada on to talk about that.
Yeah, it's hard for me to understand how you could ever pitch that to the American people, but to take nothing away from their collective intelligence. But it seems to me that's a – I mean, what John Coates is trying to do is hard enough as it is to kind of put in some additional methods of voting, I think, would drive the populace nuts.
Yeah. How about you, Trent England? Do you think – is there any reform that you think would be worth considering?
Well, I mean, I tend to agree with Jack. It was fascinating at this conference at MIT to hear several different, you know, very interesting ideas about how to run elections. I mean, I think the problem with all of them is that ultimately there's no magic about democratic processes, right? And so, I mean, a lot of the talk in all these democratic reforms is that, well, if we can just sort of maybe even trick people into feeling like they have voted for someone, you know, we've elected someone who got more than 50% of the vote, then that's a better system. You know, I think what matters is that it's legitimate and that people have a sense that we have a law, it's not biased toward one side or the other, and we're able to understand it to the degree that we need to, at least. And, amazing about the American people is we have this electoral college system, and even though a lot of people don't understand the nuances of it, people have really accepted that it's what's in our Constitution, it's the way we've always done it, and when we've had reform conversations come up in past history, the more the American people seem to understand about the electoral college, the more I think they recognize that the reforms suggested, including national popular vote, they offer a different way to run elections, but they don't necessarily offer a better way to run elections.
Jack Rakoff, you look like to say something.
Yeah, but Trent, there's a lot of evidence from public opinion polling that most Americans would do away with the Electoral College, or the majority would do away with it and would actually favor a popular vote. I mean, this is where, you know, there are a lot of things I admire about what John Coase is doing. I do happen to think, and we disagree about this, but I don't see how his proposal escapes the compact clause of the Constitution. I don't see how, in the end, we don't come back to needing to have an Article 5 amendment. I think, you know, there was a serious discussion this back in the late 60s, the early 70s. It passed the House, got hung up in the Senate, some think primarily because of opposition from segregationist forces in the South, Southern kind of states' rights guys. I actually think that it would not be a bad idea to go back and think about the Article 5 route. I think Americans have gotten really sensitive to the inequities of the Electoral College because of the battleground state phenomenon. I think John's proposal has some appeal. I think it comes with a lot of problems. It could be unstable. It could be altered by the results of a census, for example. So what's a rule for one election could be knocked out conceivably in another election. I want to try to give the American people a little more credit, you know, to discuss intelligently an issue about which we have a pretty strong basis of information.
Let's go back to the phones and up to San Rafael. Linda is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. I understand the U.S. Constitution no longer is a model for other countries, in part because of the Electoral College clause. And I was curious, how do the Canadians do it?
Well, they have a parliamentary system, but...
Yeah, I mean, Canadians have essentially a parliamentary system. So, I mean, the chief answer is, I mean, there are other nations that have strong presidentialism. I mean, France obviously would be a good example. But, you know, most other nations prefer parliamentary form of democracy where you only control the executive, where you can form a majority coalition that controls the legislature. This ties in with what Trent was saying earlier, which, you know, the Electoral College may be a significant incentive for having a two-party system in the United States. But if you look at other countries, it's also clear they have a range of ideological disagreements that also contributes to forming multi-party democracies.
Interesting comment on the website from Cooper, who writes, I'd like to know whether, and I don't know if anyone can answer this, but whether voter participation and democratic participation is higher in swing states because people feel like they can make a difference.
America, it's about 10% higher in swing states.
Trent England?
The reality is that voter participation varies wildly and is driven, a lot of it's driven by simply the political culture in individual states. There is evidence that in a swing state, that there's a bump in turnout, but the reality is with national popular vote, we have to remember you're not making every state a swing state. That's not really the reality, right? Campaigns have a certain amount of resources that they spend. You're making no state a swing state, and so I think what's important to recognize about that data is that if you go to national popular vote, it's possible that actually you wind up with lower turnout overall, because a lot of safe states right now already have high turnout. You're unlikely to bump the turnout up in a number of the safe states, especially some of the smaller states that have very active political cultures, simply by tinkering with presidential elections.
John Costa, did you want to add something?
Well, there is evidence. The turnout is about 10% higher in closely divided battleground states. The reality is 4 out of 5 Americans are left out of the current presidential system, and people are coming to know that.
Yeah. We have just a few seconds left. Jack Rakove, we are heading into an election that could be another nail-biter. Do you think that, if, just for the sake of argument here at the end, if we were to have another case of Barack Obama, say, winning the Electoral College, losing the popular vote, might we see another round of, hand-wringing and discussion about some reform?
Well, more than hand, I mean, I actually think it would be a great idea. because then, it's too bad this didn't happen in 2004. I mean, John Kerry, if he carried Ohio by, I guess, something like 60,000 votes or whatever, would have won the election, even though Bush would have had, a popular majority of 3 million, give or take. Then both parties, within 4 years, would have had the similar experience. That might have shifted the political calculus a lot.
All right. Jack Rakove, professor of history and American studies at Stanford University. Thanks for being here. His latest book, by the way, is called Revolutionaries, A New History of the Invention of America. Thanks also to John Costa from National Popular Vote, Inc., Trent England, vice president of policy for the Freedom Foundation, and earlier in the hour, political consultant Ace Smith. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer, Raul Ramirez. In today for Dave Iverson, I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.